Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Public Service Commission of Wisconsin accepted the complete Badger Cooley Transmission Line project application recently. That's the controversial high-power transmission line proposed by American Transmission Company and Xcel Energy that could stretch from La Crosse to Madison. Today, we'll talk about where the project stands and how the review process works from here. But first, American Transmission Company spokeswoman Kaya Freeman explains the purpose of the Badger Cooley line.
The Badger Cooley Transmission Line project is a proposed project between American Transmission Company and Xcel Energy to link the La Crosse area with the Dane County area with a 345 kilovolt transmission line. The process works is that we're required to propose two routes to the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. Over the past few years, we have done some pretty extensive public outreach, and based on public input and routing considerations such as construction, cost, engineering, environmental impacts, and other things that we look at, we have come up with two proposed routes. Those were submitted to the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin in October of 2013, and we recently received a completeness determination in April of 2014. We are anticipating a decision on the project. If the project is approved, we're anticipating them to order a route in April of 2015.
So let's break down a handful of the different things that you brought up. First is this idea that with the Badger Cooley project, it would upgrade the existing power lines into these 345 kilovolt lines. Can you explain to people what exactly that is and why it is that these power lines need to be upgraded?
Well, this is actually an entirely new project. It would be a new 345 kV line, a single circuit line between the La Crosse area and the Dane County area. So it would be in addition to the transmission system, it would bolster electric reliability. It would provide an interstate connection. At this point, Wisconsin is fairly limited in our interstate connection. So this project connecting up with the CapEx 2020 line would help us access lower cost power and also renewable power to the west of Wisconsin.
So those existing smaller power lines, those would still be in existence, or do they sort of commingle then with the different 345 kilovolt lines?
They are all part of the electric transmission system that serves not only the state of Wisconsin, but also the region. It's an interconnected grid, which provides reliability, also access to renewable energy and lower cost power. So there are lower voltage lines for the transmission system in Wisconsin. There are 69 kV lines and above. This is 345 kV, and this would be the highest voltage in the state.
And you mentioned the CapEx project, and just to remind people, the CapEx 2020 project is a similar high-power transmission line project that's coming from the Dakotas into the La Crosse area. That project was approved by the PSC, and actually construction's underway for that. And so then, as you said, the Badger Cooley line would then connect with the CapEx 2020 line.
That is correct. So these are both projects that provide regional benefits. They provide so many benefits, in fact, that the regional grid operator, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, has designated them as the Badger Cooley project as a multi-value project. These projects are noted for having a combination of benefits, and I've mentioned the obvious benefits of reliability, renewable energy, and cost. These projects also provide an economic return for electric customers. MISO has estimated that these multi-value projects that provide regional benefits will give a $23 return for an $11 investment annually. So there's pretty significant benefits, and in addition to the reliability benefits of the project.
Let's talk about the renewable energy aspect of this. I understand that, you know, there's this need and want to bring wind energy in from North and South Dakota area. But will there also be, it's not just wind energy that's coming through on this line, it's also coal energy as well, correct?
Correct, yes. Any type of energy that's generated at a utility scale, and since we're, you know, high voltage transmission, we transmit utilities, what they say is utility scale power. So it could come from wind, it could come from coal, it could come from hydro, gas-fired plants, any of those options. Electrons basically follow the path of least resistance and move along the grid, so it could be any type of power that would be moved along the line. But this this project in particular has been identified as one that would help integrate the high-quality wind resources from the west into the area.
And these high-power transmission line projects, this isn't completely unique to Wisconsin. These are efforts that are going on across the country.
Correct. There has been significant efforts for a few reasons. The transmission grid is an aging system, and you know, the need to upgrade it and keep it in good condition is very important for electric reliability. There's also been an increased focus on the regional energy marketplace and lowering the cost to energy, and also providing access to the lowest cost power. Additionally, there has been a focus on more renewable energy. There are coal plant shutdowns that definitely play into that energy puzzle, and just the desire for most folks to use renewable energy if at all possible.
How much of it has to do with just aging infrastructure of the existing power lines, but also increased energy usage throughout the country?
I think that it all plays in. There's energy usage, there's the need for electric reliability, there's a need to have reliable energy during, you know, all circumstances. There's been quite a lot of storm issues that have happened throughout the United States, and it's put a real increased focus on making sure that the transmission system is in a good enough shape to handle any issues that may come about if there's a severe weather event, or any dramatic change if there's a, you know, significant increase in electric demand down the road, 8 to 10 years. Projects like this are being planned and put into place to provide, you know, reliable electricity for today, tomorrow, and into the future. As I think hopefully everybody's noticed, these projects, a lot of thought and planning goes into them, and it takes a lot of time to get them built, about 8 to 10 years, for a project of this size and scope.
One of the pieces is because of the size of the structures. They're not easy necessarily to install. I'm wondering if you can talk about those.
Yeah, the structures for the 345 kV lines, they do vary. And in the application, if anybody is curious, the application is available on the PSC website. And they do go into structure types. There's different types of structures, monopoles, H-frames, in that. And they can range in size from, depending on the design, about 90 feet. The average, I believe, is about 120 feet typically for a single circuit 345 kV line. And they can go up to 150 feet typically, but I think the average for this line is about 120 feet. Obviously, you know, we want to make sure that our projects are compatible with their environments as much as possible. So it does take quite a lot of time to make sure that, you know, when we propose a project, we're proposing the best project we possibly can. And then when we engineer it and build it, it's compatible with the environment.
And when you're planning a project like this, how far in the future do you have to look and hope that it maintains itself?
Every year when ATC does project planning, there's a 10-year assessment. So each year, our transmission planners look at the ATC system, and they look at a bunch of factors that we need to meet. The baseline one is keeping the lights on and electric reliability. There's also the desire for renewable energy and low-cost power. For the Badger Cooley project, they have used a 40-year analysis for the economic portion of it. So with the 40-year net economic benefit analysis for the Badger Cooley project, we're projecting that there will be benefits of between $118 million and $700 million.
I'm wondering if you can help us break down those costs a little more, because you talk about the economic benefit associated with the project. The project itself could cost anywhere between $540 million to $580 million, depending on which route it ends up taking in the end. So how exactly is the line and the project itself paid off? And how does that work into the future when you look at these economic impacts, I guess?
As far as the project costs, when we submit a project, we do have to have costs that go to the PSC. The project costs are, estimated and completed, and those are paid by electric ratepayers. For this particular project, since it's a multi-value project, the electric ratepayers in the Wisconsin area are going to pay only a portion of it, about 15% of the project. Because it's a multi-value project. And I did mention the MISO estimate of the return on investment of $23 of return for $11 invested annually. When we talk about economic benefits, these are benefits on top that exceed the cost of the project. So basically, the project pays for itself, and the way it does that is with access to lower-cost power.
So how do those returns work out maybe for an individual customer in the end?
The returns in the end for an individual customer that they're projecting is a $23 return for an $11 investment.
There are opponents out there that oppose the line, and there's many different reasons, and everyone has their own reasons for the opposition. One of them is that there's some people in the area that say, why can't we produce local energy? Why do we need to bring in energy from the Dakotas or further out west? How does ATC kind of explain that to people who are concerned?
What we say is, I think it's all part of the puzzle. But as far as ATC and Xcel Energy and these projects go, it's really important to make sure that we have electric reliability and the transmission infrastructure to meet the needs of today, tomorrow, and into the future. Transmission provides a lot of value. It provides a lot of benefits. There are the economic benefits for the project, and there are the high-quality renewable resources. It's a little bit challenging to get, high-quality wind in the Wisconsin area just because it's not as efficient, and the wind blows more out west. So it's one of those things where the renewable energy coming from the west is more efficient and also provides additional economic benefits.
One of the other points that some of the opposition members make is that, the growing energy demand may not actually be there in the future, and that the numbers may not necessarily match what ATC and Xcel predicts. I'm wondering if you can help us sort of understand the energy demand and how that plays into this project.
Sure. What we do at ATC, our transmission planners look at a few things when it comes to anticipating the needs. We look at the historical numbers, so a few years back, of what energy has been used, and also use forecast information. This forecast information is what the distribution utilities expect to use. It's the energy that's expected to be used. And looking out into the future, the growth hasn't been as robust as it previously was during the really high economic times, but there is still a projected growth, into the future of, I think it's 0.8 or 1% approximately for the near future. So it's not growing as much, but there is still growth. And there also are other benefits of the economic and renewable energy that need to be taken into account.
As you mentioned before, there are two routes that the Badger Cooley line could end up taking. Both travel quite extensively down Interstate 90-94, but there's other portions that run through more rural areas. I'm sure you'll be hearing a lot from, and the PSC will be hearing a lot from landowners who are concerned about these lines running through their land. How is it that ATC works with landowners if the project does end up running through their land?
We work very cooperatively with landowners. Basically, the process, if the project is approved, once a route is ordered, it kicks off a pretty extensive process with our real estate department, where they would get appraisals and get a chance to have their own appraisal done as well, and negotiate at the end an easement for the project. An easement is basically permission for ATC to access the land and use it to do any kind of work that would be needed. The property would still be owned by the landowners, so it would just be an easement around the transmission line.
Kaya Freeman is a spokeswoman for American Transmission Company, which has proposed constructing the Badger Coulee Transmission Line project from La Crosse to Madison. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Now that the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin has determined that ATC and Xcel Energy have submitted a complete application, the agency moves on to the next phase of the application review process. It'll be hosting open houses to hear public comments about the Badger Coulee line. I talked with Dan Sage, the PSC's Assistant Administrator in the Gas and Energy Division. Before explaining the public scoping process, he talks about the PSC's role in the application review process for projects like the Badger Coulee line.
Well, the Public Service Commission is responsible for both, one, determining that the company's application makes a case that there is a need to build the project, you know, and then secondly, that this is the best project or this is the best resolution or response to those needs. And then in addition to that, also the siting of it in terms of if you're going to build, for example, if it's a transmission line like we're talking about now, what route it will actually take. So the company's required to bring, for example, when we're talking about a route, the company is required to present the commission with two alternative routes so that have the ability, so the commission has the ability to choose between the two routes. Sometimes there, for example, might be portions which cross over between the routes, so you might go back and forth between the two routes. But so that's basically the commission has the ultimate responsibility for the approval, rejection, or modification of the project as it's proposed.
And to say the very least, it's a very complex, multi-year process anytime one of these projects is proposed.
That is correct because, I mean, the company has done a tremendous amount of work and research before they bring the project forward to the commission. We then have to look at the information that they've provided in their application and determine that it's complete, meaning that they provide, there's enough information there for the commission to engage in its review process and then make a determination about whether or not the project can be approved.
So the PSC just accepted the Badger Coulee Transmission Line project application. The PSC deemed it complete. I wonder if you can tell people, when it comes to an application like this, what exactly is the PSC looking for?
Well, as I said, you know, in terms of completeness, we're just looking for, you know, what are they presenting? Are there, you know, what are they presenting as the arguments? Is there enough information and analysis? Not, you know, we're not making a determination at this point that, you know, they're right or they're wrong in terms of what they're saying, but you're looking at what's the quality of the information that they have brought forward regarding, you know, that supports the case that they're trying to make. They're saying they need to build this, and we're saying, okay, what kind of information did you have you provided? What kind of analysis have you done so far? Is it robust enough that we can say, yes, we can at least start moving forward with an official review of this case then? So, and that's both from an engineering perspective, an environmental impact perspective, and then from, you know, like an economic analysis in terms of the need for the case.
So at this point in time with the Badger Coulee Transmission Line project, one of the stages we're in right now is the public comment period. And that lasts until July 15th?
Yes, that's correct. What we're in now is that a project of this nature requires that the commission prepare an environmental impact statement, which again is a document that we create jointly with the Department of Natural Resources, or DNR. So one of the first things that we do then is that we've got the information that the company provided with its application. Now we have, we enter into what we call a scoping process where commission staff goes out to the public and holds meetings, open houses to sort of reach out to the public to say, okay, these are the impacts that we've identified so far. What are the concerns that you see from either, from a local perspective, how it affects your property itself, your community, or whatever, in terms of the resources that are there, because you depend upon the public to a certain extent to complete the information, because the people who live there have a ready source of information that other people from outside of the area might not be aware of.
And there are 6 public comment sessions coming up. Is there a difference between whether or not a person comes to a public comment session and voices their opinion on the project, or maybe if they write a letter to the PSC?
There's not a difference. It's just, if you come in person, obviously you have the ability to engage with a human being who can, respond to your questions then and there, and also then can probe the for additional information from the person. So you just get the benefit of the direct give and take.
Are there certain things that the PSC and the commissioners are looking for when it comes to a public comment?
You want to know, how does it affect the person individually? You want to know identification, if it's like a wetland that they're concerned about or some impact on their property. You'd like them to identify where the property is, how it's going to affect them, and what they would like to see in terms of action on the part of the commission. And I guess one of the things I always tell people, it's that you may object to a project and you don't want it going on your property, but if it ends out that something, it does affect your property, that it is approved and it is going to affect your property, it helps to know what you would like to see as mitigation of those impacts.
And I know that obviously there are so many factors that play into deciding whether or not a project like the Badger Coulee line is approved or not, whether it be, as you said before, the environmental impact statement, a part of a bigger regional energy plan. So how much weight does a public comment actually carry?
It can carry quite a bit because, it depends, as I said, we're depending upon the individual to tell us what they know or what they're concerned about as the individual, about the impacts. And sometimes, they may be aware of a resource that, others are not. So you can, you can bring information forward regarding that. Or it's like, because it can't, a project of this nature, does have impacts on individual people. And so, that the only way of finding out what that impact is to that person is for that person to come forward and let us know. And that's why I said it's important. It's like, if it's going to have an individual impact, if you want mitigation, it's like, what are you looking, what are you looking for? Yes, you don't want it to go there, but if that is the final determination of the commission, it's like, what would you want to see then in terms of mitigating that impact? Because that's very important, because only the person can tell you that. And it's one of those things where, sometimes people don't come forward until late, and sometimes there, is an easy solution or avoidance or mitigation, but the ability to do it, when it's later in the process is harder to respond. Sometimes you can get a change, even at this stage.
It's not too late in the process for people to express themselves?
No. Oh, no. In fact, I would say it's people should, be coming forward, because we all have busy lives. And so in terms of when they can bring their information forward, it's important. We always talk about there are 3 steps or 3 times in the process. Now, with the scoping sessions that are going to happen, again, when the draft environmental impact statement is actually out, which will be sometime this fall, and then again, when we actually go to, when this project goes to hearing, because just like with the scoping sessions, we will be holding public hearings in the project area again. So that would be sometime later this year.
A lot of people in this area went through a similar process, in recent years with the CapEx 2020 project.
Right.
And in talking with people after that project and the public hearings during that, many felt like they weren't listened to, or they felt jaded just because that project was approved, and at those listening sessions, the overwhelming response was that people opposed the project. So how do you respond to people when they say, well, nobody's actually listening to me in the end?
what I would say is that, you know, someone has listened. There were changes that were made at the individual level and I think in the general level in terms of routing, and that it's not, you know, the individual, it's like it's not a popularity contest, because if you were just looking at people saying yay or nay, we probably wouldn't build anything. But, you know, the commission has to take all, you know, there's a variety of things which the commission is taking into account in terms of making its determinations. It's not just whether the public wants it or not.
I'm wondering if you can remind people, you know, beyond the public comment, what is it that the commissioners are looking for into whether or not to approve a project like Badger Coulee?
Well, they will look at, again, they're going to be looking at, you know, what kind of cases the company, say, you know, made in terms of there's a need to build this project. You know, it could be something, and need, of course, you know, it's like, again, it's going to be something really quite broad, because, you know, the electric system and the, you know, that we're dealing with now is very different than it was 20 or 30 years ago. You know, 20 or 30 years ago, it's like you had a little, you know, you had your individual utility. It dealt with the needs within its own service territory. It owned the transmission lines. It owned the distribution lines. We're now looking at a system that's, you know, much broader than that. And so the needs are not just the needs at the local level. They could be, you know, they could be at a multi-county level. They could be, to quite honest, now at a multi-state level or even a multi-regional level. All of those things play into account, the economics of it. There's a variety of factors.
Once the public hearing portion ends, I'm wondering if you can just remind people what exactly the process is within the PSC.
Once the scoping meetings are done, then commission staff will, first of all, it's like we have to draft an environmental impact statement. So that will be a document, you know, a summary document stating, you know, what we're seeing as impacts, what's the research on those impacts, and, you know, trying to describe, you know, in general, looking at the, you know, like the two different routes, you know, and what are the variety of impacts along those specific routes and what would happen, how those would be mitigated. That, then there's a draft of that done. That's then published, and there's a 45-day comment period for that. Once those comments are received, then we have to, then there is an additional, then a final has to be prepared. And the final environmental impact statement is then, that's produced, that's published, and that then starts the trigger for, it's like, because you can't hold the rest of the technical and public hearings on the case until at least 30 days after that final EIS is out. You know, once that's out, then, you know, then you have the public hearings and the technical hearings where the applicants, you know, come forward and make their case on the record in terms of addition to the application materials, then they have experts and witnesses come forward and testify regarding that. Intervene, you know, people who formally intervene can also come forward at that point. You know, where you might, for example, some of the towns might intervene, you might get some environmental groups, you know, it just varies, you know, broadly in terms of, you know, who are the groups that actually become formal parties to the case. And then staff also testify. So you would have testimony from the Public Service Commission staff, from the DNR staff, and then also from the Department of Agriculture staff, because, of course, all three of those agencies would be involved in presenting information regarding the proposed project and its impact.
And then ultimately, the PSC, the commissioners make their decision, and then they issue their order.
Exactly, exactly. So there are three commissioners. You know, they go through the, you know, the testimony is, you know, done. The parties brief the case because, you know, it uses an administrative law process, and then that information is presented to the commission, and based on the information presented as part of the hearing record, the commission then makes its decision.
Dan, is there anything else you want people to know about the process or the project itself?
Well, what I want to say is that, you know, the fact that you went to an open house or something earlier in the process doesn't mean that you're done. You know, we always encourage people to continue to be engaged in the process, and they need to bring forward those concerns now, and they need to do it again, you know, at, you know, if they want, at the time of the draft EIS, and again at the time of the public hearing, because that's when, you know, the commission can then respond to those individual concerns.
Dan Sage is the PSC's Assistant Administrator in the Gas and Energy Division. We were talking about the agency's role in reviewing applications for projects like the Badger Coulee Transmission Line. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our discussion today concludes with one perspective on the questions surrounding the Badger Cooley line. Deb Severson of Sparta is with Citizens Energy Task Force.
As with the telephone industry that fundamentally changed and improved due to wireless technologies, the electrical industry has the potential to transform in a meaningful and beneficial way. Our current grid is based on aging pre-1950s technology and a centralized business model that rewards utilities based on increased consumption and increased infrastructure. The system is unreliable, inefficient, vulnerable, and incompatible with the urgent need to address global climate change. Such a dire assessment leads to the question, why aren't we fixing this? The answer given by utilities is that investing in transmission will improve the reliability and environmental impact of our grid. In the past decade, utilities have heavily invested in regional transmission to improve reliability. Despite this, each and every day around 500,000 Americans spend 2 hours or more without electricity. Brownouts, power spikes, and even minor blips on the grid cost an estimated $150 billion a year. We've known since the 70s that transmitting centrally generated electrons to distant load centers, be they renewable or fossil fuel-based, presents national security and reliability issues. Despite this, we're experiencing a rush to build even more centralized generation and more wires to send it to even more places. Why invest up to $1 trillion to tether us to trouble? Why is a quarter of our total investment in power generation devoted to providing electricity for less than 5% of the time when electric demand spikes? Why does building transmission deliver an astronomical rate of return? A couple years ago, Financial News Network reported that the largest for-profit transmission company in the U.S., a company called ITC Holdings, they said that they had the highest operating margin in the electrical industry at 52%. So I decided to compare it to ATC's profit, who is our Wisconsin-based for-profit transmission company, who at the time was singularly marketing the Badger Cooley line. When I did so, I divided their 2010 operating income by their revenue and saw that their margin was even higher at 55%. If you compare this to the 19% average operating profit for the electric industry and the 17% for all U.S. industries, it's easy to see why utilities and Wall Street would be chomping at the bit to add transmission, and why viable and emerging solutions that hold greater social benefit could be suppressed. And I'm not being hypothetical, nor am I grandstanding. Xcel Energy and ATC waged a federal battle over who would own the Badger Cooley line. And ATC has told us that looking into non-transmission alternatives is beyond the scope of the Badger Cooley project. I get that keeping the lights on is a compelling marketing message, and I understand how technical and complicated the issues are. But if you peel back the layers like you do on an onion, you can get to the center to see what's going on. And it is urgent that we do so. We are at a fork in the road that offers the unprecedented opportunity to modernize our grid. Today's electric industry is akin to when utility-owned rotary telephones came only in black, and consumers had no choice but to accept the cost and quality of their one service option. But we can evolve, and we can create jobs, save money, and address global climate change along the way. Which takes us back to the question of why. Why aren't we focusing more on energy efficiency and local generation? Why aren't we managing how we use energy to prevent peak load spikes and costly infrastructure? The encouraging answer is, many places are. Many states have much more aggressive energy efficiency goals than Wisconsin, and for good reason. Energy efficiency increases reliability by reducing stress on our grid and saves money by reducing waste. This has contributed to the substantive decline in energy use throughout Wisconsin and the U.S. Energy efficiency is also the fastest way to reduce our carbon footprint. While energy efficiency is a place to start, decentralized or local energy generation is also part of the solution. In 2012, the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said the nation's electrical future may well belong to distributed generation, such as rooftop solar, rather than central power stations and generators far from demand. And in the northland of Minnesota, they are proving solar can be a better option than natural gas when all costs and benefits are accounted for. Recognizing how vulnerable our massive interconnected grid is, the Department of Defense is pursuing the microgrid concept. Microgrids have on-site energy generation and rely heavily on energy efficiency and other techniques to manage the time and quantity of electrical usage. They can operate connected to or independent of the grid. Microgrids distinguish themselves from distributed energy by the ability to island itself from the grid and keep a defined area online during prolonged outages. Increased threat of attacks on our grid by man and nature has made microgrids a hot topic. Still reeling from the horrendous impacts of Hurricane Sandy, New York and Connecticut have joined the DoD's pursuit of microgrids to reduce the risks and impacts of outages. As advances in energy storage and renewables continue, more widespread adoption of a resilient microgrid structure is within reach. But it requires investing in a new industry paradigm. Transformation can cause old ways to be obsolete and can lead those invested in the status quo to resist and develop ways to extend the value of old way infrastructure. Regional transmission does this for the electric industry by perpetuating centralized generation, which is dominated by fossil fuels. A case in point is the recently approved CapEx 2020 line, which begins in North Dakota and extends to the La Crosse, Wisconsin area, costing more than $2 billion. The CapEx 2020 site says the transmission capacity is needed to support new generation, including renewable energy. Now, consider this in terms of the 800 years of coal in the ground and the generation mix in North Dakota where CapEx 2020 originates. In 2011, coal accounted for 82% of North Dakota's electrical generation, which is twice the national average of 40 to 43% coal. Even if wind were doubled from its 2011 share of 12% of North Dakota's generation, CapEx 2020 would still carry a disproportionately large share of coal electrons. Despite being marketed as a renewable energy hero, CapEx 2020 utilities refuse to commit to a minimum amount of green energy that would be carried, and the technology used limits the amount of wind that can reliably be transmitted, such that coal-based electrons will continue to dominate CapEx 2020's energy mix. The next step in the plan is an extension cord called Badger Cooley that could plug into CapEx 2020 near La Crosse and travel nonstop to Madison, where the coal-dominant electrons could be further traded on the wholesale energy market. Rather than rush to more and more transmission and massive investments to maintain an antiquated system, we are asking the Wisconsin Public Service Commission for a transparent, equitable and comprehensive comparison of transmission to other options. Emerging research on the influence of UV and ionizing radiation emitted from high voltage lines shows increased concerns for human, animal, and avian well-being. This alone gives cause to pause, as does the power of the resistance. Fossil fuel interests and utilities benefit from centralization, and groups like ALEC are working to protect this. Regulatory agencies are often partners in protecting the system, as evidenced by Wisconsin PSC Chair Montgomery's keynote speech at the 2012 Wisconsin Utility Investors Annual Meeting. His topic? The PSC role in protecting the private investor and future of privately owned utilities. While there is nothing wrong with making a fair profit, we deserve an energy policy that is driven by citizen needs, offers a desired service, and addresses both market transformation and global climate change.
Deb Severson of Sparta is a steering committee member with the Citizens Energy Task Force. Her perspective and questions are among those that will be shared with the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin as it reviews an application from American Transmission Company and Xcel Energy to build the proposed Badger Coulee transmission line from La Crosse to Madison. Whether you agree or disagree with the proposed Badger Coulee project, the PSC is seeking your opinion during its series of upcoming public meetings. It'll be accepting comments that will help determine the scope of the project's environmental impact statement. There will be 6 meetings held between May 28th and June 10th, including sessions in the town of Holland, Cashton, Toma, and Black River Falls. Details on all of the PSC's meetings can be found on our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. Coming up next, we'll talk with a UW-La Crosse professor who's written a history of motherhood in America. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. A UW-La Crosse professor has written a comprehensive history of being a mother in America. Jody Vandenberg Daves is the author of Modern Motherhood and American History. Vandenberg Daves is a women's studies and history professor at UWL. Her book captures what life has been like for mothers from Puritan times when Europeans first settled in America to modern days. She talked with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about why she wrote the book.
There was a need for this book, and I had a very strong, longstanding interest in it. I became a mother nearly 22 years ago, and I was already finishing my doctorate in women's history and, broadly speaking, social history. And I felt like this experience needed to be understood from a historical perspective. So I first taught the class at McAllister College when I was an adjunct professor there. And then when I came here in 1999, I developed it as part of my regular course rotation. And as I taught the class, I realized there were lots of little studies about aspects of motherhood, but there was no overarching history of the subject, even though there had been attempts to do kind of overarching histories of women in general. What really kind of made me realize the absence was when I saw a very good history of childhood by Stephen Mintz. And I thought, if he can do this for childhood, I bet it can be done for motherhood.
Now, your book is being marketed anyway as the first comprehensive history.
Yes.
Of motherhood in America. Why hasn't there been one written before?
One of the reasons has to do with the traditions of history. In other words, history started as a field about great men. And since the 1960s and 70s, we've had a lot more research into the lives of ordinary people, into women's history, feminist approaches to history. However, one of the things that animated that discussion back then was helping women get access to the public arenas to which they had long been denied access. For example, helping women have a broader place in the labor force, expand their access to higher education, get into politics. And so for a long time and still today, a lot of history of women is written about their struggles to get to access those areas, which is very important history and needs to be done. The history of private life, I think there is a little bit of a cultural bias that we, you know, that's just not really history. But I also think it's harder. You have to be very resourceful to find that history because the lives of mothers have often not been considered worthy of story or study. Mothers have been very busy and often have not been asked to sit down and talk about their experiences, have often not had time to write down those experiences. So sometimes you get glimpses of mothers' lives, even in what I did here, more than I would have liked. You have to go through the eyes of experts or people talking to mothers. There's still, I wish there was more. I've tried to do what I could with what historians have found. It's really a synthesis of many other people's work here as historians.
Your book starts with the formation of America, really. What was it like to be a mother at the time America was being formed?
It definitely depended on who you were. It depended on your class and race quite a bit, what it was like to be a mother, as it still does today in many respects. The Puritans would have a very long-lasting impact on our cultural norms about motherhood, so I do spend a fair amount of time with them. They had the idea that children were willful little beings who really needed a father's discipline. Fathers were considered the morally superior of the two parents, the important disciplinarians, spare the rod, spoil the child. Even when you see Puritan children pictured in art, they look like full-grown adults, just miniature. Puritans even discouraged crawling. They wanted children to be upright as fast as possible and independent. And this is not maybe just entirely a Puritan thing. Children were valued for their labor, and they needed to be disciplined to be laborers in many parts of the world at that time. Of course, the situation was different for enslaved mothers, different for women who were in the southern colonies, many of whom came over as indentured servants. And if they got pregnant while they were indentured servants, they'd have to extend their term as indentured servants. So it really varied a lot, but I do spend a fair amount of time with the Puritans because one of their things, too, was that the father was the head of the family, and that women's labor as mothers and in general was less valued than it was in, say, native cultures or African cultures. And so that carried forward in American history, the idea that women's role is a secondary role. The Puritans called the wife the helpmeet. In other words, she helped her husband. So that kind of separation and somewhat devaluing of women's labor had an impact later on in American history.
What are two or three of the big trends right now for modern mothers?
You know, modern mothers are still enmeshed in an interesting culture that makes them a little crazed with an overflow of advice and information. And it's interesting that even since the 1950s, we can see survey research at that time. And this is, you know, the 1950s, a lot of women are home with children at that time. And women in survey research were somewhat insecure about the job they were doing as mothers. And you still see that today. And one of the things I talk about in the book is the rise of expert advice that tended to make women constantly trying to keep up with the up-to-date advice, which was often conflicting, and then a consumer culture, which is constantly selling mothers insecurity. Do you know about the latest safety report about your children's car seat? Do you know what your children might be eating? Do you know, that they shouldn't be sucking their thumbs? Whatever it is, the magazines directed to women, for example, lure you in partly with, happy stories, but partly with the idea that you maybe aren't up to date on something you could know. And so although I think women are turning to one another now a little bit more with the internet and every family situation, you can find a chat room to talk about somebody in your situation, which is really cool because there were a lot of women who were isolated before with particular situations in their families. And I think that has changed for the better. I think the overwork, overload, trying to manage what are often shrinking paychecks is a situation that women are particularly facing. And we see this massive income inequality. And around the world, really, women are often the shock absorbers of these policies that shrink the safety net and that create more difficulty balancing out family needs, dealing with bureaucracies, dealing with workplaces. 2/3 of minimum wage workers are women. And so managing the inability to put food on the table very often continues to be a struggle for women. And that's not really new, but it's unfortunately a growing trend with the way our social policy has gone.
What are you hoping that people will take from this book?
I do hope that it will start new conversations about the role of mothers, in part the role of mothers in history, that mothers have a history that has impacted the rest of American history. Putting mothers at the center of the story reshapes the way we think about some things. I hope, too, that when we look at the fact that many cultures in the United States have created more community-oriented approaches to rearing children, not so privatized, just the nuclear family. When we look at that, we can see there are models of more vital kind of communities that are connected to families, because our ideal of motherhood, the dominant cultural idea, has been mother, father in the house behind the white picket fence, very privatized. But really, people have needed to rely on one another throughout history, and the experience of being in a family is often richer when you have broader community ties. So I hope that people will think critically about the very privatized nuclear family ideal. And even at the level of individuals and families and communities, how do we create more community so that we can have more of the village to raise the child idea that Hillary Clinton talked about a long time ago, and combat that privatization? I think another thing I hope that readers take away is how vital an expanded safety net is for mothers, that it's very hard to do this job without the economic resources and the opportunities in the workplace to do that. And I think that women's underrepresentation at the policymaking table has been a very longstanding, unfortunate continuity in American history. Women have, of course, gained the right to vote. Women have been very active on behalf of their children in many important social movements throughout American history, which we didn't talk about too much in this interview, but I put in the book. We need to know that history. We need to revitalize that history. And we need to have more women who've had the experience of being a caregiver at our policymaking tables.
Jody Vandenberg-Daves is a women's studies and history professor at UW-La Crosse and is the author of the book Modern Motherhood in American History. She spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis about the book, which is billed as the first comprehensive history of motherhood in America. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.